Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of Militia Mondays on UFTRW Radio. Tonight, our guest is going to be Gary Hunt, and we're going to be discussing all. We're going to be discussing the committees of safety, the role they played, and their history during the Revolutionary period. Welcome to the show, Gary. How are you doing?
Just fine. How are you doing, Randy?
Man, I'm doing great. I've been waiting for the show all week.
I have too.
This is one of my favorite subjects here, the committees of safety, the committees of correspondence. Gotta love them.
Well, I hate to make you feel young, but we're going to start out going back about 795 years. To the year.
That's a long time.
It is.
Do they go back that far?
Only in books. Committees of safety is an interesting concept. It's got a history in our English culture and history that goes back to the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was the beginning of what was called the British Constitution. Now, the British Constitution, unlike ours, was built piecemeal over the years, and it was never consolidated into a document. Many times there were revolutions in England that turned over government or got some people's heads cut off for trying to turn over government. But the idea of revolution is not new to our history and our heritage any more than the committees of safety are. Something interesting, unlike French revolution, something interesting about the English revolutions is generally they went back to a very similar form of government to what they began with before the various revolutions. And I don't know how many, but it's perhaps a dozen, perhaps more. That they had over the course of their history from the Magna Carta to, I think the last one was in 1685 or something like that. But the Magna Carta, the first provision in the Magna Carta reads, "In the first place, we have granted to God, and by this our present charter confirm for us and our heirs forever that the English Church shall be free and shall have her right entire, and her liberties inviolate, and we will that it be thus observed, which is apparent from this, that the freedom of elections, which is reckoned most important and very essential to the English Church, we, of our pure and unconstrained will, did grant and did by our charter confirm and did obtain the ratification of the same from our Lord, Pope Innocent III, before the quarrel arose between us and our barons. And this we will observe, and our will is that it be observed in good faith by our heirs forever. We have also granted to all freemen of our kingdom, for us and our heirs forever, all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs, of us and our heirs forever." So that established foundation. They separated their church from the Catholic Church. They wanted the church to be free. We know through history that it got very rigidly free, but they set forth at the end of that the fact that these liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs forever. Now we jump to Article 37. "If anyone holds of us by fee farm, either by socage or by burrage, or of any other land by knight's service, we will not, by reason of that fee farm, socage, or burrage, have the wardship of the heir of such land of his as if the fief of that other, nor shall we have wardship of that fee farm, socage, or burkage, unless such fee farm owes knight service. We will not, by reason of any small surgency which anyone may hold of us by the service of rendering to us knives, arrows, or the like, have wardship of his heirs or of the land which he holds of another lord by knight service." Now, it's hard to understand. It took me quite a while to sort out and look back and see what these words meant, but the significant part here, "which anyone may hold of us by the service of rendering to us knives, arrows, or the like, have wardship of his heirs or the land which he holds of another lord by knight service." Well, they didn't have guns back then, rifles, cannons, and things like that, but the tools of the trade of war were guaranteed to every man, every free man, at the time, and that is one of the liberties illuminated in the Magna Carta. the sockage, the burkage, and all that was an obedience to the civil authority. So the right to keep and bear arms was subordinated to the authority, the civil authority, whether it be a lord or the king directly. Whoever was the civil authority over you had the authority over your right to, not over your right to keep and bear arms, but over your use of arms. I've not looked a lot into the English history except to look at that foundation. So now we're going to jump up a few hundred years. We're going to go to 1692.
Okay.
And we're going to have the first instance I've found of reference to committees of safety in the United States. And it's rather interesting because everything was going fine. I mean, the Plymouth Colony had their militia. Jamestown had its militia. All the colonies had their militia. But as the king's forces came over and civil government and treaties and everything were signed, there tended to be a less of a need except for defense directly against Indian attacks. New England was not separated into the states that we recognize today. It was New England. And there was a governor appointed by the crown, Sir Edmund Andros. Now, Andros had raised the quit rents. He was trying to become a lord. He was trying to raise money. So he raised the quit rents and did a lot of things that the colonists didn't like. Well, the militia existed at the time, but their subordination was to the civil authority, and that civil authority at the time was Sir Edmund Andros. The committee was a committee of safety was created in that year, 1692. It was called for by the New England militias. They didn't want to subordinate to Andros because Andros was defying the charters that they'd been sent there and was eking out their very substance, kind of like the IRS does today.
Okay.
So the militia created a committee of safety. Then the committee of safety, the civil body, not the guys with the guns, blunderbusses, but the civil authority said, Andros is not doing his job. He's a bad guy. We don't like him. So, militia, we direct you to arrest Andros and put him in jail. Or they called it Goal back then, G-O-A-L, which they did. And they held him in jail against the objections of many of the crown's servants until the king recalled Andros back to England, where he probably gladly went. It's kind of interesting that the militia, when it wanted to change its civil authority from the royally appointed governor, chose to stick with history and heritage and culture and create a committee of safety, a civil authority, and transfer their allegiance to that civil authority. We have many more occurrences during the course of history, none really significant, probably until October 4th, 1774, in Worcester County, Massachusetts. I'm reading now from an article I wrote, The End of the Revolution and the Beginning of Independence. Timothy Biglow was appointed as a delegate for Worcester County at the soon-to-be-held Provincial Congress. He was provided instruction by the convention to carry to that Congress. The instruction read, if all infractions of our rights by acts of the British Parliament be not redressed and we restored to the full enjoyment of all of our privileges contained in the charter of this province, issued by their late majesties, King William and Queen Mary, to a punctilio before the day of your meeting, October 5th, the next day, then and in that case, you are to consider the people of this province absolved on their part from the obligation therein contained, and to all intents and purposes reduced to a state of nature, and you are to exert yourself in devising ways and means to raise from the dissolution of the old Constitution, as from the ashes of the Phoenix, a new form wherein all officers shall be dependent on the suffrage of the people for their existence as such. Whatever unfavorable construction our enemies, which would be the royal government, may put upon such procedure, the exigency of our public affairs leaves us no alternative from a state of anarchy or slavery. That was the Declaration of Independence in October 1774. The royal government did not comply. Worcester County, Massachusetts, disbanded the militia, reassigned the militia, recommissioned the officers, and in every case making sure that nobody that was inimical to the cause of the colonists or anybody who was a Tory was either a member of the militia or an officer serving in that militia. Why? Because the government had not abided by the charters and had not abided by the English Constitution, the rights that were established over centuries, and the specific written charters that had created Massachusetts Bay Colony. This was preceded by an Act of Parliament. That Act of Parliament is what they considered the violation. It had nothing to do with the Stamp Tax Act, the Tea Tax, or anything like that. What they had done by the Massachusetts Government Act had dissolved the charter. May 20th, 1774, Massachusetts Government Act dissolved the charter and set up royal government at the discretion of the crown and parliament in Massachusetts. The first act then was by parliament wiping away the slate, saying, now you're subjects of us, you're slaves of us, you have to do what we say. Your government does not exist. In fact, you will not elect anybody except to town commissions or committees. We will appoint all judges, all delegates, everybody that serves in government except on the town committee. Now, your town committees, your town meetings can be held once a year, and we have to approve the agenda of that meeting before you hold the meeting. So all the rights were just ripped out, taken away from these guys. And so they declared that they were in a state of nature rather than a state of slavery. They then created a committee. Now, committees have gone through gone by various names over history. The one that I, when I first started looking into this, that I ran into most often was Committee of Safety. There were committees of correspondence that were set up by Sam Adams to communicate between the towns and counties in Massachusetts and between the other colonies, and many of them retained that name nearly throughout the Revolution. There were some associations. Actually, it was an association that had created the Worcester Declaration. They were never, Worcester was never a Committee of Safety the entire time, but their association served that purpose. So the name doesn't matter so much as the concept. At any rate, it becomes quite clear that when the government fails to serve the people, and I'll give you an example. Quite often, the government was not able to deal with the Indian attacks on villages or on towns and communities.
Okay.
So it was local. It was the responsibility of the town to appoint a militia, to commission officers, to provide them with weapons or assure that they had weapons, shot, and powder. They established watchmen to watch at night to make sure that they weren't attacked by Indians in the dead of night. This was all the responsibility of the local community. That local community is the basic element, and Jefferson was very accurate when he represented that it is the most important government to us, is the basic element of our society. As was true then, one town might have a dominant religion, and you paid tithes to that dominant religion, or you moved out of town. But you could always find another town that had a religion comparable to yours. Now, some colonies, like Virginia, it was strictly Anglican Church, which is why the religious rights movement by Jefferson in Virginia wanted to open religion up to the religion of your choice, not just the Anglican or Episcopal Church.
Okay.
But the committees of safety have been a fundamental recourse to people for defense, for communication between other towns, villages, colonies, states, counties, cities, towns, whatever. They've been there for the common defense. They've been there for organizing the community. If they had to build a bridge over the river, if it washed away, the committee would assign the responsibilities to get that done. Okay. Now, in the last couple hundred years, we've seen an absolute transfer of all that authority to the government, to the ones that we tithe to or pay taxes to. They have taken all those responsibilities away from us and assumed them themselves to the point that we are even denied our fundamental rights. For example, if there's an earthquake, try and go in and see if anybody's in a building that you can pull out and save their life, and you'll see a yellow crime scene tape, and you'll see police officers that would rather beat you over the head than let you possibly go scratch yourself while trying to rescue somebody. And they will protect that scene until the first responders get there, the firemen. And if you watch the news this morning, I got a kick out of the firemen standing a distance away from a car with two people in it in floodwaters, and the water was coming up and coming up. And nobody thought of putting a rope on and trying to reach these people and secure the rope to the car and take them back to shore. Instead, they sent for a boat, and it took about 20 minutes for a boat to get there. So these guys don't even want to risk themselves like they used to save somebody's lives. They're not getting paid to anymore. They're getting paid too much to care about their job. So we've lost the attitude of helping our neighbors. It's been taken away from us by force if necessary. We've lost the ability to decide for ourselves what's best for us, how to protect ourselves. The flack over the Arizona Senate Bill 1070 is probably a very good example of that. When we, even by a state, try and assume control again to enforce laws that have been on the books for many years, the federal government mocks us, as does most of the press. But anyway, the concept of committees of safety is quite phenomenal. Now, how could they serve us today? Well, we had a peaceful, peaceful transition of government, not a peaceful revolution, but we didn't have the bloodshed that France had in trying to see who's going to be on top. Now that the revolution's over, the people that started the revolution were having their heads cut off in vying for power. But the transition we had through the revolutionary period was unique in the world, really unique, because as hostilities began, even before hostilities began, in fact, on April 12th, 1775, 1 week exactly before Lexington and Concord occurred, John Hancock was the chairman of the Massachusetts Committee, and they put out a notice, and it's on the front page of committee.org, put out a notice that said every town and district in the colony has to establish a committee. In fact, I'll read it. Whereas the preservation of our country from slavery, now this, remember, this is after Worcester, Massachusetts did what they did. Whereas the preservation of our country from slavery depends under God on an effectual execution of the continental and provisional measures for that purpose, resolve that there be now appointed for each county in this colony a committee consisting of five persons, any three of whom to be a quorum, whose business it shall be to receive from the committees of correspondence in their respective counties a state of the conduct of the towns and districts with respect to their having executed the continental and provincial plans as aforesaid. And it shall be the duty of said committees to meet on the first Wednesday of May, July, September, November, January, and March, and prepare a report of the same to be laid before the Congress at its then next session, that any neglect of such towns and districts in executing such plans may be speedily and effectually remedied. So what he called for was every town to set up a committee of safety to begin communicating so that they could coordinate together. Now, they'd already created the Provincial Congress in Massachusetts, and it was called for by the committees prior to this. But the fact that, knowing that things were going south really fast, the fact that they had the foresight to organize committees of safety, and from them delegates were sent to the provincial committees of safety, and from them delegates were sent to the Continental Congress.
Okay.
That this system was built from bottom to top. And it was a necessity, but what it did is it had a government in place, not military officers, but a government in place during the entire period of the Revolutionary War. So the transition into Articles of Confederation and eventually into the Constitution went without a hitch, or a significant hitch, I guess is more appropriate, because there was a civil government in place all the time. George Washington might have objected what the Continental Congress said, but he never disobeyed them. He begged them to provide him men and money and arms. He had a few run-ins with them, but he always subordinated his authority to the Continental Congress, which had created the Continental Army, of which he was put as the commander-in-chief of. So the committees of safety play a very significant role in our history, an amazing one that you don't find in textbooks.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier that Jefferson thought the committees were invaluable, and he thought they were so invaluable, in fact, that on his deathbed they were a major concern that was on his mind. In fact, one of the last things he ever said was, I'm going to butcher this quote. I know it's been so long since I read it, but it was...
Do you want me to stop you before you do? Because there is no proof of that.
Oh, really?
I have a book called Founding Myths. It's rather interesting. It's written by a guy named Ray Raphael. Now, he wrote The First American Revolution, which talks about what I was talking about at Worcester, Massachusetts, and a number of other events where men under arms went to courts and closed the courts down. But there's a rebirth in American history, and it's not revisionism. The revisionism occurred over a century ago.
Right.
And it wasn't really revisionism then. Just like Vietnam, after the war was over, there wasn't much attention paid to it. And it wasn't really until after Adams and Jefferson died on July 4th, 1825, that people started thinking, you know, that was an important part of our history, and they started giving a little more attention. But there wasn't celebrations on the 4th of July like we had when I was a kid. We don't have them any like they did when I was a kid anymore. It's now it's, you know, stand back behind the yellow tape, we will do the fireworks, and you don't bring any alcohol, and oh, crap, they do now. What freedom? But it was a century after Lexington and Concord that Paul Revere's Midnight Ride became famous. Paul Revere was one of three riders, and he was the least successful of all three. Dawes and, I don't recall the other one's name yet, got to Lexington, or Concord. Revere gave up his horse and had to walk back to Lexington. So he had a good sounding name or something, and it fit with the poetry. And then the history, as it was being written, was written to young people, and they needed heroes, they needed events, and they needed dates. So they started consolidating these into small pieces. The Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre, we can put dates on, they're singular events. The fact that for many months prior to Lexington and Concord that the colonists were taking their rifles to force judges to resign, to close courts, to challenge the British authority face-to-face with firearms, has been ignored by that history. And for some reason, people now are going in. I tell you, the Internet makes it a lot easier. You used to have to go to a research library, look through their catalog, find out what's available at other libraries. And believe me, when I started researching committees of safety, we did this. I was in South Bend. We went down to Notre Dame University, went through their catalog, found that there are documents with committee of safety in them. We wrote to those places and sent checks in some cases, but in most they would give us copies for free. And they would send back copies of the documents that we were requesting through the mail. But right. Now the Internet's available, and a lot of the stuff is being scanned and is available online. That research is a lot easier. So people like Raphael and this Pauline Mayer and some other people are saying, well, we know what history is, but let's go back and find out what the truth is, what the real soul of the revolution was. And so they're going back now, and so we're getting a resurgence. And it's a very appropriate time because we're getting a resurgence of the despotism and the tyranny that occurred back 230 years ago that caused this revolution in the first place.
I agree with
so
you. We
now this one,
running
says,
down that slope.
This one says that Jefferson, and let me see if I can find it. Go on, talk for a while.
Okay. Yeah, the quote I was going to mention that I guess might not actually be provable to
Jefferson
was I think on the death, but he said something about warn the committees or advise the committees to be wary.
Yeah, call out the committees, something like that.
You know, he was basically the quote I'm talking about was accredited to him. You know, he was saying that to warn the committees to be wary because there was bad things afoot. We remember in Jefferson's time. There was already major moves to bring in a completely mercantilist system, you know, a reversion back to the old British system of rule, except instead of one king 3,000 miles away, we were looking at 3,000 kings a mile away. You know, and that, a lot of that was, you know, Hamilton's works and his efforts there to bring back in basically the entire British Parliament system because, well, he preferred a monarchy. In fact, if you look at his writings, he said that, you know, a monarchy was much more realistic than individual rule over a country. You know, with a monarchy, you only had one king to worry about, whereas with what he saw as a complete, you know, basically he saw the Confederacy and the Constitutional and the Republic as basically being a bureaucratic kerfuffle that would very easily get out of control and very easily take over.
You mean he predicted the future?
Well, he had a helping hand in making it.
No, I can't find it right now in the book, and it's not in the index, but this is kind of an interesting book. The Don't Fire Until You See Whites of Their Eyes wasn't quite true. They actually set out at a certain distance, and when the British reached those stakes, they were supposed to begin firing. What's described to John Adams apparently was true. It was reported slightly differently by different sources, but he said, is it the 4th of July? And he was told yes, and he said, Jefferson lives. I'm not sure which one died first, but they both died that day. But I couldn't find, they couldn't find any original documents of anybody present who ascribed anything at all to Thomas Jefferson. So that might be one of the stories that have embellished history to make it more palatable for young people. But now it's time for us old people to look seriously at history. But yes, I appreciate that. I always thought there was a great cause, and I've been talking about the quote, and in talking about committees of safety, I used to quote it. And I thought it was great. But, you know, if we learn that we're in error, we need to get back to the truth because
exactly
the consequence is we've lost sight of the fact that people picked up rifles long before Lexington and Concord. Three times, Gage was going to send out his soldiers to keep a court open, and three times Gage wisely decided not to. Gage was getting pressure from England to do something about this problem you've got there. On September 2nd, 1774, Gage was advised that tens of thousands, perhaps as many as 100,000 patriots were marching towards Boston armed. Now, a rumor had gone out for some reason that the British who were in Boston, occupying Boston, were burning Boston down, and people were coming from as far away as New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, heading towards Boston, and it may have been as many as 100,000. There's no way to count because once word went back the other way, no, there's nothing wrong. And ironically, the people in Boston, the patriots in Boston, are the ones that said, send the word out. No, we don't want them to come. And they worked with the Crown Gage to make sure that Boston didn't become a battlefield that day. So the revolution could have started on September 2nd, 1774, as well as April 19th. Now, Gage, in his best desperation to do things, tried some covert actions. He sent some soldiers to one town to seize the arms. They got to the bridge. It had been torn up. The officer demanded that they put the planks back on the bridge. He said, this is the King's Road. And the local people said, this is not the King's Road. We built it with our hands. And they finally made a deal. We'll put the bridge back up. And the British officer said, we will go six rods beyond the bridge and turn around and return to Boston, which they did. They kept their word. So he could at least say he got across the bridge, but he never got into town to seize the arms. The next event, and this is pressure from the Crown, you got to do something, was to try and sneak into Concord and steal the arms there. Well, we know that didn't go off very well.
No, it didn't.
It seems our intelligence was better than their intelligence. So it was just, it wasn't quite like we believed. It was just a matter of chance. And actually, the actions of these thousands of patriots with rifles on their shoulders before then forced the British into trying something desperately to show the Crown that Gage was doing something right.
Okay.
So we forced it. It didn't just happen.
No.
So those of
it
you
never
that
just
are waiting
happened.
For
it's always the efforts of a few people who step forward.
It was the effort of thousands of people that step forward, tens of thousands.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the grand scheme of the things of the population at the time, that was a small number.
Well, they were the ones affected immediately. It was Western
right.
Massachusetts that started the revolution, not Boston. You know, that's the misconception. That's the big misconception. Boston, with all the attorneys, got all the glory. But yes, it was a relatively small handful, but it was in some cases 20 or 30,000, which is a lot of people to come together in a small Western farming community, Western Massachusetts farming community. So the word was getting out, and people were willing to travel. In fact, some events, people traveled 2 days to get there. 2 days to be there when they were called to come with the rifles to make sure that a court didn't open. So it wasn't just a matter of circumstance. And, you know, I've been hearing for 20 years now, I'm just waiting for Lexington and Concord, and then I'm going to pick up my rifle. Well, it's interesting that so many rifles were picked up so long before Lexington, Concord, and they were all done under the auspices of Committee of Safety or one of the names that it goes by, the Association, Committee of Correspondence, Committee of Protection. But they were all civil authorities that authorized their militia and anybody that wanted to join the militia and pick up a rifle to go. So what part do committees of safety play in our modern world? Well, I got to back up now only about 20 years, 15, 16, 17 years. After I got back from Waco, I went on a speaking tour around the country and then got back to Central Florida, Orlando, and I'm scratching my head, you know, why hasn't there been more outrage over what happened in Waco? I got back to Florida. I had a pretty decent library in my office, law books and everything. I'd been studying this stuff for over 10 years at that point. I didn't have a lot of history at the time, but I had a few history books, and I picked one up and started reading it. And just one of those many things that, you know, sometimes you feel there's some guidance behind you.
Right.
I opened it to it was a series of essays about the United States history. And I opened it up, and then I went to the beginning of that essay that I opened it up to, and it just made reference to the committees of safety. Very light, not a whole lot. It was the modern form of, not the currently, which I mentioned, form of history, but the modern form of history. But it mentioned committees of safety. And I started thinking, committees of safety, and I think it was talking about the committee of safety had called the guys to come to Lexington Green. And, you know, committees of safety, what role did they play? So I started looking more and more into committees of safety. And then when I got back out to South Bend with Dave Leeper, a friend of mine, that's when first we started the Committee of Safety in Orlando. That's right. When I got up to Dave's, we really started doing some research. I had written the first Volume 1 of Committees of Safety, which is available online at committee.org. If you go to committee.org, down at the bottom, there's a 3x3 matrix, and how to start your own Committee of Safety, I think, is the one. If you go there, at the bottom of the page, you'll find links to PDF files. But the first July 1995, I finished this first volume. And I guess I had some of the information from South Bend, but David Leeper kept working on it. And when I got back up there, we got a lot more. But here's one that we ran across, and we had an original image of this document. Cambridge, April 29th, 1775. This may certify that the bearer, Mr. Paul Revere, is messenger to the Committee of Safety and that all dispatch and assistance be given him in instances that the business of the colony may be facilitated, signed by Joseph Warren, chairman. And there's copies of these documents, and we started getting these documents, and we're just astounded at what we came across. Later, when I was back there, we put together Volume 2 of Committees of Safety, which most of this work is Dave's research. He found a number of documents that give good examples of many of the activities the Committees of Safety conducted. Now, one that happened even before Lexington and Concord was surrounding communities, their Committees of Safety would gather blankets, food, even some firearms from time to time, and try and sneak them into Boston to the people that remained in Boston when the British were occupying Boston. But the embargo was not allowing food to come in by sea, and they had a heavy reliance on a lot of goods coming in to Boston Harbor, and that was denied. The only thing that was coming in was the royal supplies on the king's ships. So all these committees are sending blankets for winter and firewood and chickens and pigs and cows, everything into Boston so people can survive. So the committees of safety function in a humanitarian capacity when the need arises.
Well, you know, that's something I've always thought was the role of the committees of safety and the militia itself was not just in a militaristic aspect or a political aspect, but in the overall well-being of the community. Gathering blankets during, you know, really bad snowstorms to make sure that people aren't dying in the cold. Food during natural disasters, gathering water, you know, looking for lost children if need be.
Right.
You know,
or having a watchman out there to make sure there's no fire or Indian attack during the night. All
exactly.
Those are humanitarian. So yes, they served a purpose that the government did not fill. Now we have given absolute reliance on the government, and we find out the police officer has no obligation to protect you. Look, see what we've lost in the meantime? Boy, it's astounding. I mean, if I learned all this at one time, I would keel over. I mean, what I've learned over the last 17 years in researching committees of safety, and I'm still learning more. I found out about a book that was put together in four volumes, and I've got two volumes of it now. It was by Peter Force by 1838, and from the Revolution to 1838, he had accumulated and transcribed any document he could find. If it was one sentence signed by somebody out of a committee of safety. So he's got documents from the New Hampshire Committee of Safety, some examples. When they were setting up a procedure for voting, this is Saturday, November 4th, 1775, so it's after the war had begun, but before the Declaration of Independence, voted that the delegates or representatives to be chosen to represent this colony in future shall be chosen by the voices or votes of the electors and not by the value of their estates. See, it used to be the wealth got to pick things like we have now. That every elector or representative in this colony be possessed of a freehold or real estate of the value of 20 pounds lawful money in such town or place where the election shall be. That every person so elected shall be worth 300 pounds lawful money in real estate in this colony. The election to be adjudged by the selectmen and the moderator of the meeting, saving an appeal to Congress or the House of Representatives. Now, that was by the Provincial Committee of Safety. It's interesting, too, that they didn't, if anybody were on welfare, they definitely would have not had been a freeman or had a freehold. So the people that are dependent upon government are excluded from voting, and they had removed before then. You had to have a certain amount of wealth before you could vote, so only the rich people, the elite, in many instances, were the only one to be elected or the only ones to be able to vote. So they brought it back down to the people, except those dependent on the government. You had to own more than you owed, is what it amounted to.
Right. Well, so I got a question now. In today's society, what could we do with the committees of safety if we reestablished them? I mean, what purpose could they serve for us? Or are they just a nice little footnote in history for the Americas?
Well, they're a nice little footnote in history. There's no doubt about that. But let's see. Let me find it. And I think it would be easier. I spent a lot of time writing it, so I'll read it. At committee.org page, there's a little piece I wrote called Potential of the Committees of Safety in this Troubled Nation. If we wish to understand just what potential exists if committees of safety were created once again to deal with the problem of government, we might begin, as the founders did, with consideration of a voice directed at the government. As fruitless as our organized efforts have been by writing, faxing, and calling, and by any other means available to us as individuals to affect the course of legislation, there is hope that these efforts can be harnessed and directed in a manner that is assured to have the desired effect. In March 1765, the Parliament enacted what is known as the Stamp Act. Immediately, scores of resolutions were passed by colonial committees directed at the Parliament or proclaiming the position of the community in regard to the Act. The colonists who were not represented in Parliament had no member to petition for repeal of the Act. The unity they displayed by their numerous methods of opposition resulted, however, in the repeal of the Stamp Act in 1766. Among the proclamations with which we have become most familiar, No Taxation Without Representation, is probably the most well-known and was a result of this effort against the Stamp Act. I believe the Lexington Concord was the initial act of war when I wrote this. Understand that. Representation, then, is one of the results that evolved from the actions and attitudes of the time. Had representation chosen by free election existed then, the outcry against the Stamp Act would surely have been directed at those who represented the colonists and probably would have reduced considerably the amount of time from enactment to repeal. With the unity demonstrated by the committees and the respective committees, the repeal of the Stamp Act was inevitable. Should we apply through the modern Committee of Safety a concerted effort at effecting pending legislation or even initiating legislation, unity demonstrated by the committee would become one of the most significant lobbying efforts in the country. I'm going to interrupt right here just to interject something. If a petition went to Congress from the committee, Congress, the member who received it, would say, well, who is this committee? Now, if it comes from Tea Party, Inc., or noamnesty.org or something like that, they know who it is. And chances are they've already got some of their people in that organization to try and mute the voice that's being expressed. But when you've got people that aren't joining an organization but become the organization themselves, it's a lot harder to infiltrate because they have to be from your community to begin with. And it's a lot harder to mute the voice when it's not a specific purpose, but the majority of the people there perceive a problem and say, this is a problem, let's deal with it. So it has the potential of being as effective as the NRA, if not more so. Back to the article. I just got ahead of myself because I talked about getting being as effective as the NRA.
Okay.
I'm going to go down a little bit. Perhaps an anecdote might illustrate the potential of the Committee of Safe. The ability to affect legislation could easily be applied on local issues and might become the catalyst to bring together many advocacy groups that otherwise remained unaffiliated because of their diversity of interests. The common elements of the return of authority to the will of the people and the restoration of constitutional government are the only common elements that are necessary to achieve results in effective legislation to achieve those goals. Perhaps an anecdote might illustrate the potential of the Committees of Safety. Shortly after the first meeting of the Central Florida Committee of Safety, I was contacted by a detective from the Orlando Police Department. That was in April 1995, shortly after the bombing in Oklahoma City. We agreed to meet at a restaurant and talk for quite a while. I had arranged for my own safety and to avoid any concern over the consequences of the meeting for a number of fellow patriots to be sitting in a booth adjacent to where the officer and I met. The officer's concern was that the purpose of the committee's of safety really was. I explained to the officer that the primary objective was a unified voice, as was outlined above. As the discussion continued, he asked whether there was any affiliation with the militia. My response was that the term well-regulated militia, according to what history reveals of the matter, is one that is subordinate to the civil authority of the people, and that this civil authority was, in the earlier period in our history, the Committee of Safety. I assured him that if all militia in the country were willingly subordinate to the Committee of Safety, as they properly should be, the likelihood of a group of militia taking any action such as what had occurred in Oklahoma City would be absolutely minimal. I continued to explain that the Committee of Safety could also be considered a double-edged sword. Although restraint would be applied to militia, should the government ever give good cause to the militia to act in defense against enemies, foreign or domestic, the unity created by the Committee of Safety would enhance the ability of the militia to achieve their objectives, especially if the action was in response to a national emergency. So that pretty much sums it up. I mean, we can be creative. And, you know, there's one thing I wanted to talk about tonight. I hope we've got some people from the Gulf states listening. I was talking to a friend last night about this, and the concept of Committee of Safety is when the government is not, and in all the events I've described to you, it's either absence of involvement by the government, i.e. Indian raids, etc., or the government not doing what they have to do to protect our lives, our liberties, our property. On the Gulf Coast right now, from what I've heard, and, you know, I have not verified it, I'm not spending a lot of time investigating it, but I keep hearing over and over that in Gulf Isle, if you go in with the camera, you're liable to get arrested or have your camera taken away. If you go into Gulf Isle, you can't get into certain areas of the public beach. Now, understand, public means belongs to the people, and the government has no right to restrict you from that public beach. If you go take samples of the water and the oil at the beach, you might be arrested. That they're doing everything they can to put a veil of secrecy around what's happening in Gulf Isle. Now, if a committee of safety from any region affected by the oil spill, either now or potentially to be affected in the future, was concerned and wanted to get independent analysis of the oil, get visual and, measured and photographic evidence of the distribution of the oil. Wanted to talk to any local people without fear that those local people were pressured into not talking freely. That a committee of safety from 1215 on for the last 795 years has had every authority to look out to the interest of the people. So a committee of safety from a county, say, that had five people that wanted to form a committee of safety, and then that committee of safety wanted to assign themselves as a committee or assign others as a subcommittee of the committee of safety to go and investigate that what was happening down there. It would do a couple of things. It would provide us an opportunity to tell the press that, look, you cannot damn these people for going and looking into this. It's not the government's job to look out for the people. It's the people's job to look out for the people in this country. And if you don't believe me, here's a document that shows what committee of, here's two documents to show what Committee of Safety has done historically. You'll take the edge off the press having to take the side of the government, I don't know what the adjective to use to describe them, the other government, the rebel government, the one that's taken, usurped all the authority.
Tyrant.
The rebel government, that instead we're going back to the committees of safety. We're looking out for the interest, and we want to know. We don't believe those people. They tell us one thing, they do another. They've lied. There is no transparency. And we want to know what the truth is. Now, we could get the press with press releases. We could get the press possibly behind these people. And I'd be curious to see what that sheriff that's been stopping people from going in there would say if this group of Committee of Safety went along with their own contingent of people's press with cameras and everything. I had a couple dozen of them with video cameras. Went down there and said, we're the Committee of Safety, and we're going to take samples. We're going to talk to people, and we're going to take pictures. And we're doing that because we have every right in the world to protect ourselves and our property, whether it be from foreign invasion, natural disaster, or anything else. Now, if the government said, screw you, a lot of people might wake up real fast. But my guess is if it were done properly, politely, cordially, and absent the militia, that it might be very successful, that it would be very difficult to turn down American history in favor of the rebel government. So, I'll tell you, if anybody is interested in talking with me further about what could be done down there, and I've got some ideas, and I can't go through, we don't have time for me to go through all of them. We've only got
We've got
a half an hour left, but
we've got 36 minutes left.
But I would be glad to work with anybody that wanted to put one together. Now, if I were able to, I'd go down there and join you. If you have somebody who would provide me gas money, I'll come down and join you and go out on the beach and collect samples with you. I would love to see a demonstration of that historical right we have to look out for ourselves, even when there's a government in place.
Well, you know what, Gary? I actually know an individual down south who's going down there this weekend, I believe, and he's from the Mississippi Militia. He's going down there to provide escort for media that wants to go down to the beach and is being set upon by private security, the Thorn Corporation?
Well,
Thorn Security?
He should have... really, I don't have a problem with militia going. They're hiring armed thugs, aren't they? But they should be going. If they're militia, they should be going under the authority of the governor of that state, or say Alabama or Mississippi or Louisiana or Florida, of that state, or a committee of safety within that state.
That's what I was going to have them do. I was going to try and see if I can't get you guys in touch with each other, and you guys can talk about that.
Well, militia is subordinate to the civil authority, and that's, we have two things happening in this country today. We have militia establishing themselves, saying their obedience is to the governor, and even writing to the governor if there's a flash floods or something, saying, you know, can we help? And I think in almost every case, if not all, they're saying, oh, we don't need you. We got qualified people to do this. Likewise, the common law court, the grand juries, they're working absent authority. Now, let's go back to Worcester, Massachusetts. After they declared that they were in a state of nature, within a couple of weeks, they had set up courts to deal with civil matters, or criminal matters, not civil. They felt that civil matters, most of them owing debt to Tories, could be put off until everything was resolved. But if there were a criminal charge against somebody, they set up courts to deal with that. But the courts were set up under the authority of the committees of safety. So the courts, like the militia, cannot create themselves.
Right.
Back in the 90s, some friends of mine, the common law court, Tampa Common Law Court, if you go to outpostoffreedom.com and go to Journal of the Times, you'll see Tampa Common Law Court or Florida Common Law Court. I forgot what I titled it, but I testified in a trial there, interestingly, about committees of safety. We had a form for joining the committee of safety that said, let me find that real quick. It was kind of interesting because I testified for one of the defendants in the case. And he was the only one I testified on behalf of, even though I knew most of the people that were on trial, he was the only one that subpoenaed me. Now, when we started the Central Florida Committee of Safety, this is the form, and it's available on that page. It says, Central Florida Committee of Safety, request to be considered a participant. Name. And then after that in parentheses, and it has a blank, and after that in parentheses, it says, is this your real name? And it has a checkbox, yes or no. Well, a couple people marked no. Then it has address was optional, city and county. The county had to be mandatory because you had to be within that county to be in that committee of safety. The state had to be mandatory as well. And then postal zone if you wanted, phone number and fax number. This is before email. The address is required to receive mailings. Phone number is required to be called with meeting or other information, fax number, if you desire to be on the fax network. Are you aware, then it went on with this, are you aware that there are at least two classes of citizen in this nation, i.e. U.S. citizen, citizen of the United States, state sovereign citizen, yes or no? If you answered no to the above question, you are not eligible to participate in the Committee of Safety. Then below that it says, are you now or have you ever been? One, a banker, officer of any financial institution, yes or no? A bar attorney, a member of the ABA, yes or no? A law enforcement officer, federal, state, or local, yes or no? If you have answered yes to any of the above three questions, you are not able to attend or participate in the Committee of Safety as a result of your willful revocation of your citizenship in this country, and then signature, and then after it says seal. Now, no witnesses required, but that was the form that we used. Now, this fellow that went by the name of Robert Chapman, we found out later his name was Quigley, his real name, but he had joined the Committee of Safety, and he had said, yes, that was his real name, which it wasn't. He had answered no to the bottom three questions. Now,
okay.
Quigley had been to my office a number of times. You know, we had lunch together a few times and all that, and had no idea that this guy's an agent, but he ended up testifying against these people. So when I testified in Tampa, I pointed out this form, and I said that it said seal at the bottom. That means I swear to what I've said above. And he said it was his real name, and it was not. He said he was not a law enforcement officer, but in fact, he was an undercover IRS agent. That's a law enforcement officer.
They enforced.
He was willing to lie then to deceive us. Well, Toby Brown was the only one acquitted. Toby was the one that examined me, asked the questions of me in court. So that helped protect the expectations we had that who we were dealing with was who they said they were. And I thought it was pretty significant. Now, there's another document that's kind of interesting, and the Albany Committee, I've got two volumes of notes from the Albany Committee of Safety. And this is a revision of the General Association oath that they took.
Okay.
But it says the General Association agreed to and subscribed by the members of the Committee of Safety for blank, blank, persuaded that the salvation of the rights and liberties of America depends under God on the firm union of its inhabitants in a vigorous prosecution of the measures necessary for its safety, and convinced of the necessity of preventing the anarchy and confusion which attend any nation such as we are and have been to the ministerial tyranny of its government. We, the freemen, freeholders, and inhabitants of blank, being greatly alarmed at the avowed design of the U.S. government to raise revenues by means contrary to the constitutional authority granted them, to enact contrary to the constitutional authority granted to them, and to remove those rights granted by God and preserved by the Constitution, do in the most solemn manner resolve never to become slaves to that government, and to associate under all the ties of religion, honor, and love to our country, the United States of America, and under the authority of the Declaration of Independence, to adopt and endeavor to carry into execution whatever measures may be recommended by, and that we will in all things follow the advice of our committee respecting the aforesaid, the preservation of peace and good order and the safety of individuals and private property. And then it says down at the bottom, we, the subscribers, inhabitants of blank, do voluntarily and solemnly engage under all the ties held sacred amongst mankind at the risk of our lives and fortunes to defend by arms the United States of America against hostile attempts of the enemies, both foreign and domestic, until such time as these threats to our future security cease to exist. Now, that was the association. Now, there was one other document, and I think I don't have it up there, but it was rather interesting, and it was in their oath, and I don't know why it wasn't in there, but it was kind of interesting because they said that they would never divulge any of the information discussed in the committee meetings unless given permission by the committee or in a court of justice, not a court of law, but a court of justice. I'm going to have to get that one and get it up there.
I've got a question for you from the room.
But I thought it was interesting that they refer to a court of justice, not a court of law. And if you think of the significance of that, we have become a court of law, and the government writes the laws, the rules, and we have to abide by them or else. Okay, go ahead with the question.
As far as the committees of safety go, what was their structure? Were they based upon a county structure? Were they based upon a state structure? Was it based upon a national organizational structure with each state having its member representatives? How was the actual formation of it created, and how did you go about actually creating it?
Yes, to all of the above, but if you go to committeeofsafety.org, Vieira's site, he's got it wrong. He relied on one book, and almost the entire book is up on my page. The Provincial Committees of Safety of the American Revolution by Agnes Hunt, Ph.D. It was written about 1906 or something like that. But it's the history of the Provincial Committees of Safety, but they came along later. The Committees of Safety go back to community. They always have evolved out of the community. The First Continental Congress was called for by a few committees of safety or equivalents. And so the Continental Congress was not a constitutional body. It was a meeting of delegates that were sent by respective committees. Some states had provincial committees by then. Others did not. Some sent them from the royal government's committee. Some royal governments shut down their houses for trying to send committee members to this. But it starts, fundamentally, it's upside down to the structure that we're used to. The community, a town, a plantation, a county, can form a committee. John Hancock in that letter said five people, three of whom to be a quorum. So if you have five people in a town or a county, a parish, a village, a plantation, an apartment complex, I suppose, they can form a committee of safety for that area that they're in. Now, they can't form a committee of safety in Smithville that incorporates the whole county, they've got to, you know, represent at least various parts of the county if they want to call themselves a county. But it was a community of whatever size, as long as it was a not a majority by a long shot, because in Albany, which had hundreds of people, the Committee of Safety generally had 20 or 30 people at a meeting out of hundreds, or thousands, perhaps thousands. Someday I've got to look into the population of Albany at the time. But then they sent delegates, the towns and plantations and villages sent delegates to the county committee, and the county committee sent them up to the state committee when the state committees all came into being, the provincial committees that Agnes Hunt wrote about. And some were slower than the others. I think it was 1778 before all the colonies had committees of provincial committees. They were working under different auspices, but finally, eventually, they were all calling themselves provincial committees. And then they sent delegates up to Philadelphia or New York or wherever they were going to have their meetings. So it builds from the bottom up, regardless of what area you're representing, and what you represent has to be represented. For example, one county can't make the whole state, but say you had five counties, then you can have a state committee using the numbers that Hancock gave us.
Okay.
Now, understand the concept, too, and we've all heard when you go down to vote for a Republican or a Democrat, you're voting for the less necessary, the lesser of two evils, but you still get an evil. And, you know, I found that wasn't getting the message across, and I came up with a new analogy the other day. I say if the Republicans dangle a turd and the Democrats dangle a turd, no matter who you vote for, you're going to get a turd. Now, I think that makes it a little clearer. Now, back then, though, people were pushed up from the local committee to the county committee to the state committee to the federal convention.
Okay.
Congress. Now we've got national parties dangling people in front of us on a local level, and they'll even, Hillary Clinton moved to New York so she could be a senator from New York. That whole idea was unheard of back then. But that's the party saying, we want Hillary, we can get her in New York, so let's get her in there. So we need to get back to government working from the bottom up. Let people work locally and work their way up, and if they excel, then the people locally at the town, and then the county, and then the state will praise these people, not just support them because they're the Republican or Democrat candidate. And each state will have somebody that's really good, and whoever's spoken of best will move on up the ladder.
I've got a question for you.
Self-government.
I've got a question for you. It refers back to what you had mentioned earlier about Dr. Edwin Vieira.
Yeah.
Now, you and I have had discussions on that. And you had mentioned that all of his ideas come from one book, and you had just mentioned that book a minute ago. I forgot, what was the name of the book again?
Well, if you go to committee.org, you'll see on the main page, the provincial, down at the link box on the bottom, it's the six links down there, the Provincial Committees of Safety of the American Revolution by Agnes D. Hunt. It was published in 1904, it's out of copyright. New York and South Carolina are the only two states that I haven't finished OCRing and putting in there. But it talks about, the chapters are the New England colonies, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, Connecticut. Chapter 2, the middle colonies, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland. Chapter 3, the southern colonies, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. Chapter 4, general view of the character and work of the committees of safety. Chapter 5, origin of the committees of safety. Now, this deals strictly with the provincial committees of safety. And for the most part, with the exception of Massachusetts, they didn't come into being for quite some time. Now, Vieira, one thing that bothers me about what Vieira said is he said the committees of safety were composed of existing legislatures. Well, they weren't party legislators back then. It wasn't the Democrats or Republicans, but it was the legislators that stood against the crown and said so openly that went in. But most of the people on the committees were not on the legislature before, especially in the heavily Toried states. They came up through the committees of safety to the provincial committee of safety.
So basically what Dr. Vieira is saying then is that the committees of safety were formed from the politicians not from the people.
That's what he's suggesting in what
Right, that's what he's suggesting.
And I find no credibility to that whatsoever.
Wouldn't that take the power of the Committee to Safety out of the civil authority and put it back into the state authority?
It is time now.
Would defeat the purpose of the committees then?
Look at it
to go along with his line of thinking.
I'm going to go back to Red Beckman. I don't know if you know who he is. I don't know if he's still alive, come to think of it, but he was a patriot back in the 90s and 80s and very outspoken. He's written a number of good books, but he describes the government as a pyramid or a triangle. The way we see it now, the president's at the top, then the Congress, then the states, then the people way down at the bottom. That's top-down politics.
Right.
That's wrong, though. Now, what I'm trying to describe now is take that triangle or that pyramid and turn it over. George Washington realized he worked for all the people. He's at the bottom of the pyramid, at the point. The top of the pyramid is we the people. That's the proper role of government, with the people at the top. Now, the difference between a republic and a democracy, if it's a democracy, it's mob rule, because these people at the top that rule can go by whims and fancies and warm, fuzzy feelings. But instead, as it filters down to the president, supposedly wisdom and thought and consideration of matters that people might not consider tend to filter out those mob rule applications. And when it finally gets down to the president, it's his job to make sure that the enactments of Congress are carried out. So he works for everybody. He works for all of us. Well,
exactly.
The government has turned that pyramid upside down with the point up.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, it was the committee's responsibility to remove politicians who had violated their oath of office or violated their office in any way. So if they were made up of these very same politicians, how would they remove themselves?
Well,
why would they remove themselves?
That's the problem. Like I said, the ones that moved over laterally, like Jefferson and Madison and John Hancock, John Hancock was not on the Royal, but there were a lot of them. Pinckney, I can't think of them right now, but there were a lot of people that were in the royal legislatures, the royal governing bodies, were outspoken against what the crown was doing.
Right.
A good, for instance, though, is Pennsylvania. And so those ones transferred over because they'd already proven to the people, and they were voicing the will of the people. So why kick them out because they were in the crown's government? Because they've abandoned the crown's government, they come over to ours, and they're still speaking for the people. Those came over. They'd already earned their way out. But those that took the king's side did not. But these people were speaking the will of the people. Now, Pennsylvania is a funny case because Pennsylvania had I think it was called a general court, that was still loyal to the crown because the Quakers did not see any reason. They didn't like what was happening, but there's no reason for war, and the war had already started. And this is leading up to the Declaration of Independence. So the Continental Congress sent out a memorandum or a resolve or something to all the colonies saying that if you have not done so, you need to start a new government in your colony that is separate from the crown, that will act in the capacity of the government of that colony until such time as the problem is resolved. So masses of Whigs in Pennsylvania created a second general court, and they sent their delegates to the Continental Congress, who accepted them instead of the original government's delegates because they supported independence, and they got that final support for independence, and the royal government that had tried to maintain its power just dissolved. It went away. Nobody listened to them anymore. They were just pushed to the side by this new government in Pennsylvania. Now, the new government of Pennsylvania was created by the Committees of Safety. They pushed the people up. They pushed the old people out, and they became then the representatives of Pennsylvania in the spring of 1776. So the way it works is the will of the people filtered to reasonable by the thinkers is how the whole process works. The basic form of government is committees of safety. Or was. Now, if you've got
basically the four system of checks and balances within our checks and balance system. You have the,
well,
have the Congress.
It's the will of the people. It's not a political party saying, oh, here's our plan for America, and then getting a couple of them passed and saying, we did our best. This is
grassroots. It is the government.
Grassroots, where people say, we're sending delegates up that will stop administrative agencies, that will stop giving money to every country in the world, that will stop wars unless they do a declaration of war, that will stop welfare and free handouts to people, that will enforce our border laws, that will force BP to either clean up or we will clean up and send a bill to BP. That will, you know, it has to come from the people. Look at the outrage in this country in the last couple of years. Is that a consequence of government serving the will of the people?
No.
It can't be.
No, it is definitely not. It's the exact opposite. In fact, it's the government serving its own will against, in direct violation of, or in direct contradiction of what the will of the people is. We can see that with the health care bill that passed.
Right. Now, Washington spoke very bad of political parties. But understand, political parties back then were social clubs. They didn't raise hundreds of millions of dollars and dole them out to their candidates. They didn't pick who was going to run for state, for city, county, and state and federal offices. They didn't do all these things. They just, and I'm going to use federalists and anti-federalists as a good example. Some had sympathies this way, some had sympathies that way. But each of the representatives went unencumbered. He tended to side with his party and believe stronger central government or stronger local government, but there was no, he didn't have to get the blessings of the federals to run for office, state, county, or local. He did not expect to receive any financial support at all from these people. He might expect, if he ran for office, encouragement and maybe letters written to the newspaper on his behalf from members of the same sympathy. But now we've got political parties that you will not get support of a political party unless you have been a party dog and done the will of the party for and proven yourself for years. They then will fund you as necessary to get you elected. That increases your obedience to the will of the party. Who runs these parties? Do you think the Democrats or the Republicans run their parties? No, they've signed on one side or the other, and they tend to allow the herd mentality to allow them to fix on the goals of that party. So they're not dictating what's happening. They're accepting what's happening, and they're thinking there's only two choices. That too, and back to the You Have Tread on Me petition. It says in there that no political party should influence the outcome of any election, no contributions or anything like that. It also makes it easier for anybody to run for office by setting maximums on what can be charged for somebody to be a contender for elected office. The power of the parties has destroyed and created this upside-down triangle. Upside-down triangle or right-side-up pyramid, wrong-side-up pointed pyramid. Parties have allowed that because they dictate. Now, do you really know who runs those parties? I'll bet you'll never find the names of the power brokers that have the greatest amount of influence in those political parties. They've got lackeys at the top of the party. They're telling those people what to do. Think about it. It surely isn't coming from us when they come up with their platform. Now, a lot of it is things that some people would like to see. Say, if you're a Democrat and we're going to increase welfare payments by 20%, man, you just bought a few hundred million votes by that very claim. So it's something that some people might like to see, but then they're going to throw a lot of other garbage in too. They might start taxing unemployment benefits, but you'll never notice that, or they'll never announce that. But the parties run the show. We have lost control of our government to the two-party system and the people that control that system. If we go go back to committees of safety and start pushing people up from the bottom. And once he joins one of the political parties, kick him out of your committee. Story that we might force things back. Unfortunately, right now, when more than half the people in this country are dependent on the government for their primary source of income, whether it be by employment, retirement, or entitlement, they're going to vote for more money, most of them.
Well, this is true. I mean, right now, if you look at the U.S., we have 60% of the population in the U.S. receiving some form of government paycheck.
Right.
Which means that those 60% of the people are being supported by the 40% left who are working and paying all the taxes.
Right. And those 40% don't make enough to do it, so what they're doing is backcharging our great-grandchildren.
Exactly. You know, when people say that, well, if you're getting a government check, you know, like if you have a job with the federal government, that you're paying taxes too. But we have to remember, the money they're paying you with has already been taken from the people who were paying taxes. Your paycheck is a tax. So the money you give back does not replenish the, does not build up the coffers, it just replenishes what was already taken from the original 40%.
Right. They just, it's like saying that we're going to give them $10, but we're really only going to give them $8 an hour. And we're going to keep the other two that you gave us already.
Exactly.
There's no
$8 of your money is now gone.
There's no net gain on the income. It's just some is retained that appears to be going out.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a pretty contemptible system, and then a lot of that then goes into dues fees for, or union fees for SEIU or something. Now we'll leave that.
Yeah, all kinds of fees. We have fees up the wazoo. In fact, right now, if you take a look at it, you know, our political party has put us into a position where we're taxed almost 55% of our income on a yearly basis, in the over 200 types of taxes we have. Now, this is amazing considering the fact that we're a country that was born out of revolution over taxes and fractional reserve banking.
Yes.
And our tax rate right now is so astronomically higher than what it was at the time of the revolution.
Well, it's one of the highest in the world. And see, you're forgetting one thing, though, because when you have that 40% that you retain, wait, what did you say, 55%?
You got 40% that are actually working in the private sector. The other 40% get some kind of government check or entitlement.
No, the percent of we're paying.
Oh, 50, yeah, upwards of 55%. So some numbers say 60, but I'll be conservative and say 55.
Well, let's go with the 55. That leaves you 45% of what you've made to buy something, right?
Exactly.
Now, something I ran across in 1989, I think, it was an article, and it said, "Would you buy?" The title of the article: "Would you buy this car?" And it said, car, $10,000. Would you buy this car? Well, if the price tag was $10,000, yes, I'd buy this car. And then down below it, it says, would you buy this car if the price of the car was $1,800 and the taxes was $8,200? No, I wouldn't buy the car. It went to show that of that $10,000, $8,200 was actually going to taxes on the downstream on the production of that car, whether it be mining fees, transportation fees, taxes or benefits paid to the workers that build the car or process the materials and everything, that only $1,800 actually went out to make the car.
Exactly.
So
well, listen, Gary, we're down to our last 4 minutes here.
Out of that 45%, you're down to really effectively having about maybe 10% of what you earn that is really going to productive creation of the product that you're buying, the products you're buying. You say we're out of time? Hello?
We are down to our last 5 minutes, actually, and I was going to use the last couple of minutes of the show to announce a couple of things that I wanted to put out there. So, Gary, why don't you do us a favor? Close us out on this one. Now, the committees of safety is something that I want to continue looking into, so I also want to get back with you again about working up another show on them and delving into, you know, how we can go about and actually start looking at developing the committees of safety again, how we can start creating and forming them in our own, you know, however it is.
Okay, well, let me give a very quick announcement first. For those of you that might be interested in looking into this, especially with regard to what's happening in the Gulf states, if you write to Gary, G-A-R-Y, at outpost-of-freedom.com, and indicate your interest, I'll be glad to start working with you on more information that might help you be able to establish and utilize those committees to affect what so far has been uneffectable. And if you have trouble with the email address, go to the webpage, outpost-of-freedom.com. Almost every page down at the bottom or near the top, you'll find a mail link. You can just hit that and send me an email showing your interest, or you can do it from the mail links at committee.org. Okay, Randy, you quick.
All right. No, actually, you're great. I actually was going to have you toss out all your information and let everybody know how to get in touch with you as well. So you've already taken care of that, so don't have to cover that.
Okay.
Is there anything else you wanted to close out with?
No, I think that covers it, but those in the Gulf Coast region, if you're concerned about what's happening and really want to know, CBS, CNN ain't going to tell you, but you can tell yourself if you stand up for yourself. And
take personal responsibility, always. Always take personal responsibility. If you want to know something, go find out.
That's what self-government is.
Personal responsibility. Well, the Bill of Rights should have been named the Bill of Rights and Personal and Responsibilities. The Bill of Rights and Responsibilities.
You know, I think that most people listening to this program already understand they have responsibilities. I guess the confusing part might be, well, how do I demonstrate those responsibilities? How do I apply them? And that's exactly what we're talking about, and we'll talk about it whenever Randy schedules the follow-up on this program. We'll go into detail on expressing those responsibilities.
All right. Well, Gary, thanks a lot for coming on, man. Always. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate you taking your time out to, you know, help educate and inform us about, you know, some really important information that most of us really don't even know about. In fact, you taught me a whole bunch yourself, and that's, you know, that's really saying a lot, because I thought I knew a lot already, and you really go into a lot of different areas where I'm not that well versed in.
Well, I thought I was well versed too, and as I say, as I read this new research is coming out, I've got to take what I believe. For example, Jefferson on call out the committees.
Yep.
Is not. I accept it's not true because there's nothing that's set to sit back to 1825. So, but we can all learn, and that's the whole idea. And we've all got to take responsibility now. I would have wasted my time studying all this stuff if you didn't give me an outlet to help other people understand it, too. So thank you, Randy.
Oh, well, hey, it's always my pleasure to have you on. All right, and now I've got a couple of announcements out there. PatriotResistance.com. It's a really incredible militia networking site. They're holding a fundraiser, a donation drive. But unlike other donation drives that other people do where they just ask you for a bunch of money and beg and plead and ask you to give, and give you nothing in return, these guys are actually going to give you something in return for donations. If you go to their website, www.patriotresistance.com, you're going to see on their front page a donation and fundraising drive. Click that link, you're going to go down, and you'll see that depending on the number of donations, on the amount of donations they bring in, if they hit their goal of $1,000, they're going to have a varying scale of awards they're going to hand out that they're just going to give away to whoever enters into the drawing. It ranges anywhere from an incredible, actually, it's an Elk Ridge Bowie knife that I actually have myself. I've got one of them. Up to a Molly tactical vest complete with all the bells, whistles, butt pack, knife, compass, you name it, it's included in there. The Molly tactical vest and all the accompaniments are worth over, I believe it is $286. So get involved, get registered for the drawing. And depending on what kind of funds are raised, you'll also see which prize is going to be awarded. Get involved, help out, do what you can. He's actually got some great things planned for the site, and I was 60 seconds left. I don't have any time to go into them, but I'll tell you about them on the next show. With that being said, also check out Freedom's News Hour on Blog Talk as well. Freedom's News Hour. That's Lori Stacy. She does a show every Saturday at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. Incredible show. She does a lot of research. She does a lot of work. She writes some incredible articles over at the Examiner as well, the Sioux Falls Conservative Examiner. So go and check out her writings. Like I said, some incredible research being done by her. And she does a pretty incredible show with a lot of incredible people on there. So you want to stop by and take a listen to her. The Sentinel Program.
is much like is a system that was that is already in place and developed by the Patriot Resistance, and it is much like the Committees of Correspondence. It's a fast alert system. It's also a intel gathering and debunking source as well. Check that out and get involved with it. It's so you can find that on the Patriot Resistance as well. And as always, go check out Frankie Sheen's website, www.lonewolfresistance.com. The stuff that Frankie talks about on his website is vastly important, and the skills that he references and some of the ideas that he gets into about survival itself, well, they very well could one day save your life. So go look at his videos, his articles, and see what you can find out from him. See what you can learn. Send him an email. Tell him thank you. Or ask him questions. Tell him he's full of it, whichever one you want to do. With that being said, thanks a lot. We'll see you here again on Sunday for our Survival Sunday show with David again. We'll be discussing energy, alternative energy, and energy storage for off-grid and bugging out. And then next Monday, I'll announce what the next Militia Monday show is going to be about. So until then, thanks, everybody. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here. So thank everybody that listens to this live and on archive. And again, if you want to get in touch with Gary, you can reach him at his website, www.committee.org. Thanks a lot for stopping in, and you guys take care and have a great week. Bye-bye.